before I introduce our speaker for the day, I've got a few announcements. First of all, if you have not already, please silence or turn off your cell phone so we do not have any interruptions. If you'd like to learn more about the Science Forum, you can visit us online, scienceforum.utk.edu, or follow us on Facebook if you're so inclined. We also have a sign-up sheet for our mailing list. You can sign up back here with writing it down. If you could write where I can read it when I put it into the MailChimp, that'd be great. And if not, if you prefer to type, you can go to our website and sign up electronically there as well. For those of you without the golden ticket of a UT parking permit, we have those available for community members. I will send out an email about that, or contact me for having that mailed to you at the beginning of the week. Let's see, website. How many of y'all heard our ad on WUOT this week? Yes. Okay. Mally Hubert is not going to be speaking, but Molly Hubert will be. And then next week, we'll be back here, same time, same place, with Dr. Craig Towers, who is a professor of maternal and fetal medicine and vice chair of obstetrics and gynecology. I'm not going to be able to talk today, I'm sorry. At the Medical Center of UT, talking about opiate drug use during pregnancy. All right, see if I can do better with the introduction. It's my pleasure to introduce Molly Hubert, who received her bachelor's degree in biology with a minor in statistics from Penn State University. She received several scholarships and awards for academic excellence during her time at Penn State, including the Division of Science Award, the Hend International Scholarship, the John Danhaus Martz Jr. Scholarship, and the John Beverly Bernardi Scholarship. Molly also held several positions with three separate state agencies where she worked exclusively with invasive plant species and their impact on the environment. She is currently a PhD student here at in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and Dr. Mona Papesh is her advisor.
Welcome.
For her dissertation work, she focuses on human-caused disturbances and ways to prevent such disturbances. Since joining the graduate program at the University of Tennessee, she has received several awards, including the Hessler 2018 Herbarium Student Award and the 2018 ORE Summer Graduate Research Assistantship. She is presently the coordinator of UT's Darwin Day and the EEB Undergraduate Mentoring Program, as well as a Scientific Teaching Fellow. So today, I'd like to have Molly present Rising from the Ashes, the Gatlinburg Fire and Plant Recovery.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Amanda, and thank you everybody for coming today. I'm very excited to be here. I'm excited to share some results and share what I know. I am Molly, and I'm going to be talking today about the Gatlinburg Fire and some plant recovery that we're seeing. So just as an outline of what I would like to cover today, first, I'd like to talk about just some general fire background. Secondly, we'll move into the effects of fire, then wildfire as a disturbance in general, wildfire across the United States. So there's a big base of knowledge in the Western United States on wildfire. So we're going to want to take some of that and apply what we know. And then plant succession in general. And then lastly, the Gatlinburg Fire and plant recovery there. So first, we're going to talk about wildfire as a disturbance. So fire has been a force in shaping landscapes for thousands of years. In the Southern Appalachian region in particular, lightning fires are a re-emerging, yet largely historical dimension of the landscape, which is illustrated by the presence of fire-dependent species. Anthropogenic fire quickly took over lightning fires, and all anthropogenic means is just human-caused. But historically, fire has been suppressed since the human expansion in the United States and European settlement. Because fire suppression in the Southern Appalachians has led to the establishment of hardwood trees, plant communities that are currently present are more prone to high-intensity fires. So the diversity of plants in the ecosystem kind of depends on the disturbance that is happening there. So when we talk about fire and the impacts that it has, we can't talk about it without first talking about disturbance theory. So community ecologists generally approach disturbances as a multivariate set of variables that describe some type of disturbance at hand. These variables consist of measuring frequency, size, intensity of a disturbance, and in the context of wildfires, they're usually characterized as one of two types. Surface fires, which would be a low intensity fire, or a crown fire, which would be high intensity. So if we look up here at this conceptual model we have some type of stable state here. So it's some type of ecosystem that's in a stable state. And when we have a low disturbance acting on this ecosystem, it generally keeps that disturbance in the stable state. Arrow right here. However, if we have some type of high intensity disturbance, we'll take this ecosystem in its stable state and we'll kind of push it to a new alternative stable state, noted right there. So also, there's not just the option of a low disturbance or a high disturbance. We also can have something called an intermediate disturbance, which leads to something known as the intermediate disturbance hypothesis. So basically, the intermediate disturbance hypothesis just says that when a disturbance happens, you'll see more type of richness in an intermediate area than you would in a low or high area. So we have this nice little conceptual model over here, noting low disturbance or disturbance on the x-axis from low to high, and species richness on the y-axis. And species richness just means how many different types of a species there are. So if you note here, in the low disturbance area, we generally have a low amount of species richness. In the high disturbance area, we also generally have a low amount of species richness. However, if you go somewhere in the middle here, we get the most species richness. We'll be talking about that a little bit more today. So wildfire as a disturbance. So fire is a common disturbance that ranges in intensity, and it effectively creates patches of disturbance that produce diverse plant communities. So fire plays a well-recognized role in maintaining these plant communities and their composition, and sometimes it can determine the progression of an entire ecosystem. Now, whether that's through anthropogenic, human-caused wildfire, or some type of natural cause, or lack thereof, that can determine the progression, distribution, and structure of some type of ecosystem. Now, also, this does not limit invasive species in this case. So disturbances can cause some type of ecosystem to be more susceptible to invasive species. Now, talking about the Western United States and wildfire there, as I mentioned, the Western United States does have a lot of reoccurring wildfire, so there's a very large knowledge base out there of what happens to plant communities after a Western wildfire. So because of that wealth of knowledge, we can take some of it and apply it to the Eastern landscape. The Western US is currently experiencing intense wildfires, which can continuously change and reshape the landscape. Fire regimes in the West are considered characteristic, meaning that it's the dominant type of disturbance regime associated with structures for forests and sites. That also means that the plants out there are extremely adapted to this fire regime because they frequently depend upon it, and it's the variability of fires plays a large role in that as well. So moving to Eastern wildfires and how we can compare those to the West. So with drastic changes in climate, widespread drought, and consistent fire suppression, anthropogenic and natural disturbances can be expected to increase in the coming years. So for the East, to kind of manage to continue to control widespread high-intensity fire effectively, management needs to be put in place to allow low-intensity burning to occur. And in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, that is something that does happen, but I just wonder if it's frequent enough. Now, without fire, ecosystems tend to favor fire-sensitive and shade-tolerant competitors. And once this happens, we see reoccurring mesification, meaning that we get species that rely on shade, damp conditions, that are less fire-adapted and more homogeneous. So when we talk about fire, we usually talk about the bad things about fire, but there are some things that are beneficial. So when we have low-intensity fires, it can have regenerative properties on an area. So when we have low-intensity burning, it generally clears out brush from underneath. It can clear out some grasses. and increase soil nutrients to help reduce competition and bring back native species. Also, low-intensity fires are encouraged to kind of halt large fires. So if you continuously burn a low-intensity area and kind of clear out that debris and maybe some weedy species, that means it's less likely to burn more intensely in the long term. However, for all of this to occur, there does need to be optimum conditions, which is very hard to obtain. There needs to be low wind, it needs to be the right temperature. A lot of things need to happen. Stars need to align just in the right way for this to occur. So it doesn't happen very often, unfortunately. Okay, so following some type of disturbance, we get these stages of plant succession that show how resilient an ecosystem can be. So all plant succession means is when a disturbance happens, it's how the forest recovers afterwards. So we can start over here at some type of disturbance early on in time. In our case, it would be the wildfire. And then you'll end at some type of steady state over here. So first, the first thing we would expect to see is bare rock. And all these pictures I'm going to show you are over time in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park that I've taken. Secondly, we'll start to see some mosses and grasses occurring. Next, we'll see grasses and perennials, things like Kalmia latifolia, so mountain laurel. Next, we'll see woody pioneer species in fast-growing trees, such as black locust. And then lastly, we'll reach some type of steady state where the canopy will recover. We'll have more hardwood trees recovering. And unfortunately, we have not quite yet reached this state. Okay, so now I'd like to move into Gatlinburg plant recovery. So just a little bit of background on the Chimney Tops 2 fire. This was a man-made wildfire that occurred in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and it spread through Gatlinburg in late November of 2016. It burned over 11,000 acres, displaced thousands of citizens and animals, and it was very devastating. However, because of the fire suppression that we've seen in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, forest management practices for many decades, the plant communities that are present are more prone to high-intensity fires. So why is this important? Why do we want to study plant communities? Well, knowing how plant communities respond supports management practices in the park. So if this were to ever happen again, we'll know how the ecosystem recovers, we'll know where it recovers, and what types of actions we need to take to help that. Secondly, this is a chance to study both anthropogenic and fire disturbances. So as I mentioned before, anthropogenic just means human-caused. So because this fire went into the urban area of Gatlinburg, we can see what happens in an urbanized area with plant communities compared to a natural area like the Gatlinburg, like the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And we can see a range of fire disturbances as well. And then lastly, our results will help us understand urban impacts on plant communities. So like I mentioned, since this fire was in Gatlinburg and burned parts of Gatlinburg, we can see how plant communities respond in an urban area. Today, though, I'm just going to talk about the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Okay, so with our study, we have two hypotheses. First, the plant communities after the fire disturbance differ in species richness and diversity across the fire gradient and across the natural and urban gradient. And then secondly, disturbance across the fire gradient generates new patterns of species dominance over time, and we'll talk about what that all means. So some of the methods on how we did this study, as I mentioned, this did take place in the National Park and also in Gatlinburg. But to give you kind of a reference point on where we're at, this is the National Park. You can see Gatlinburg right there. We sample essentially within that circle. And if you zoom in a little bit, those are our sampling sites. And I'll talk about what the colors mean very shortly. So how we determined where we were going to sample, all the areas that we have were randomly generated in GIS software. So we got this lovely map from the National Park System indicating what severity was where in the park. And then four The site selection that we chose across a gradient, so we'll have natural and unburned locations, meaning the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, natural and burned, urban and unburned, and urban burned. So we got, as I mentioned, we got all this information from the National Park System. And if you look over here, we have a legend that tells us which areas were which for the fire intensity. So unburned locations are green, so some down here. Low, which is the bluish color. Moderate, which is the yellow. And then the high intensity burn right there on the red. So each of our sampling sites starts out as a 90 by 90 meter grid. And from that, we choose the center point of that grid. So once we reach the center point, we're within a 30 by 30 meter grid. And we randomly selected 2 1-by-1-meter quadrats with which to sample our plants from. So once we do that, and once we sampled all our sites, we got about 20 sites in total. So we'll have 3 sites at each fire intensity. So 3 at high, 3 at low medium, because we combined those 2 categories. 3 at the low burn or no burn, and then we have 1 reference site in both the natural and the urban system. So methods in the lab. While we're in the field, we do the best that we can to identify species, but if for some reason we can't, we take very detailed pictures and we also collect field specimens. Once we collect our field specimens, we bring them back to our vehicle, press them in newspaper, and store them until we can take them to the herbarium. Most of the stuff that I'm going to be talking about today is from 2017. So for these, we had a later season collection we collected in August and September. However, for this past field season, we were able to collect April through next couple more weeks. So we're going to get the full range of wildflowers from that. And then lastly, as I mentioned, all specimens are going to be vouchered with the UTK Herbarium. Okay, so I want to talk about some of our results that we found. Firstly, plant species richness is not significant across the burn gradient. So what that means is plant species richness, as I mentioned before, it's just the number of different plant species that we're seeing. And meaning that's not significant is we're not seeing any differences yet across the burn gradient. So just keep in mind, this is from 2017. So on the x-axis, we have burn severity ranging from high to low medium, no burn to reference. And at each of these severities, we have our 3 sites, which are represented by the 3 box plots. On the y-axis, we have our plant species richness, so how many different plants are at each location. So even though there weren't any differences, we did see that at the low, medium, burn sites, we had a total of 15 different types of plant species, which ends up being our highest at all of the locations. So that goes back to the intermediate disturbance hypothesis that I talked about earlier. So we have our intermediate disturbance, which would be our low, medium burn, and that's producing the most amount of plant species there, different plant species. So next, talking about plant species abundance, all that means is how many plants are there. So on the x-axis again, we have burn severity ranging from high to reference, and then on the y, plant species abundance, so how many plants were there. Once again, this was not significant across the burn gradient, so we didn't see any differences in 2017. However, our reference site had the most amount of plant species at 63, followed by no burn, which is 51. So that was to be expected since those areas did not experience any fire at all. Nothing was being wiped out. Everything was pretty much kept intact there. I just wanted to highlight some of the common species that we did see in 2017. So first, in our high burn areas, we saw things like mountain laurel and rhododendron, which are common in high altitude type of areas. In our no burn areas, more heavily trafficked areas, we saw lawn daisies and cleavers, so weedy species, kind of what you would expect to see in a heavy trafficked area. Also in our high burned area, black locust and greenbrier. So black locust is a known inhabitor of disturbed areas, and greenbrier is pretty notorious for being fire resilient. And then lastly, some more invasive type species, lawn daisies and Japanese stilgrass in our high burn areas. So for reference, I know this is kind of small, these are some of the more common species we're seeing in 2018. So just as a comparison, since we were able to get the entire field season in 2018, we're already seeing a ton more than what we saw in 2017. So a lot more species, a lot more commonly in 2018. Okay, so then also plant diversity we found was the lowest in high burn locations. So what that means is that these locations are more susceptible to dominance by one or few species. I won't talk about the numbers here, but I guess briefly, the high burn area has the lowest average at 2.25, just indicating that there's not a large diversity of species there. It might be more susceptible to either get invaded or have one or two species take over. So most commonly at these areas for high burn, we saw Commia latifolia, so mountain laurel. Our low medium burn locations, it's an unknown at this time. No burn was Bellis perennis, so our lawn daisies. And then at our reference site, Gallium aperine, which is cleavers. So our no burn and our reference site both have those kind of like weedy species. Okay, so what makes a plant able to survive after a fire? So plant communities have survived for thousands of generations and established survival mechanisms that help them to survive after these fires. So plant species might be easily flammable, such as grasses, or they might have something like serotonous cones, like pines, where they're able to regenerate very quickly. Those species that are able to survive after a high-intensity fire usually burn more readily than non-fire-dependent species. And they developed characteristics that make them so. Once again, this doesn't exclude invasive species, so they're in this category as well. They're known for being pretty resilient to disturbances and even thriving off of it. So they have also developed characteristics that make them more present when a disturbance occurs. And then lastly, as I talked about the Western US, their plants have really established morphological and physiological characteristics that make them long-lived and able to survive after disturbances. So things like that might include seeds that are able to be stored in the soil longer, thick bark, serotonous cones as well from pine trees, and tons of others. Oh, and to highlight here, these are some grasses along the High Burn Trail in April 2017, and then also some little tiny pines in a High Burn location as well in 2017. So connecting what we know from the West and some other previous wildfires to Southern Appalachia, for the East to continue to control widespread high-intensity fire effectively, management needs to be put in place to control for low-intensity burning, which is something I already mentioned. In order to do that, to control high-intensity fires, like I said, low-intensity burning needs to take place. That's it. without fire, however, ecosystems shift to favor fire-sensitive species. So something that we've seen in pre-settlement would be aspens, oaks, boreal spruce firs, grasslands, things like that. They're able to burn more readily. So some of the expected outcomes from the chimney tops to fire. Post-wildfire plant communities, we expect them to follow a more fire-adaptive successionary trajectory. So kind of taking what we know and what we've learned from this fire and applying it. Secondly, previous studies of wildfires in the eastern U.S. indicate that they give rise to significant changes in plant community composition, particularly in the understory. So it'll be kind of interesting to see what happens over time. We've confirmed that it is following a successionary path, but what is going to actually occur there will be interesting to see. So I've shown these pictures already, but just to show the successional stages that are occurring, once again, we have our bare rock, then mosses and grasses, then grasses and perennials, woody pioneer species and fast-growing trees. However, we've not yet seen canopy coverage. That's not to say that things aren't recovering quickly, because as of August 2018, this is one of our high burn sites. So this is covered in black locust, so the fast-growing pioneer species. But if you look over here, there's some maples as well. So we are having significant regrowth, and it is definitely making a comeback for sure. Also, to kind of give more perspective on this and how fast it is growing, this is April 2017 at one of our high burn sites. So you can see some little resprouts, maybe of mountain laurel there, some grasses. This is greenbrier. However, a just last week, we're seeing a lot more in that location, and that's the same location. So a lot more growth. So to kind of put this into perspective and why do we care, you know, this was kind of a freak accident that happened. It is important. We know that climate is changing. We know conditions are becoming drier. So the New York Times came out with this really cool article about a month ago. It's an interactive article called How Much Hotter Is Your Hometown Than When You Were Born? So unfortunately, everybody's going to know how old I am now, but that's okay. So in 1994, when I was born, we could expect 49 days per year to reach about 90 degrees. Okay, so fast forward to today, now we can expect about 63 days to be at or above 90 degrees on average. However, fast forward more, by the time that I'm 80 years old, we can expect between 82 and 111 days to be at or above 90 degrees. So that's a quarter of the year that's going to be at or above 90 degrees. You can see that range right over here, just indicating that range from 82 to 111. But that's intense. That's a lot of high days, a lot of increased drought conditions, dry climate. So something to keep in mind as we talk about this. So in conclusion, some of the things that we've learned, we know that it's been confirmed in the park that successional stages are mirroring some of the things that we're seeing out west. However, it's still on a case-by-case basis. We know the landscape's different out west than it is here. So how recovery will actually take place is going to depend on what we know here and now. Also, our ability to decrease fuel accumulation is very, very important. To sustain forest health and reduce the risk of high-intensity wildfire, we need to continue to control for low-intensity burning in the park and surrounding Gatlinburg. Also, as I mentioned, we can expect eastern wildfire to continue. As I said, climate is increasing, drought conditions are increasing, so it's more likely that fires will occur in the recent future. And then lastly, we need to continue this study for several years to get the full effect of what's actually happening, and that is the plan that we plan to do. So just some future directions on where we expect this project to go and what we'd like to do. As I mentioned, we're going to continue monitoring these sites long-term for several years to get the full effect. Secondly, we want to examine phylogenetic relatedness within plant species. So the plants that we are seeing, how related are they to one another? Is it something about their genetics or their family that makes them more likely to come up after disturbance? Also, examining below-ground relationships. So this is a collaborative project. There's a lot of work going into this, so we do have some lab groups that are working on the below-ground relationships to kind of get the full extent of what's happening. Also, monitoring the impact of invasive species in urbanized areas. This is a good chance to kind of look at the impact of Gatlinburg and what it's having on plant communities there. And then lastly, we plan to collect more data on western wildfires to see how we can compare them to eastern wildfires. So how are the plants recovering out there compared to over here, and what are some contrasts we can make with that? So I just want to give a shout out to a lot of the people that are working on this project. It is a collaborative project between multi labs and interdisciplinary as well. And a lot of this was funded through the Office of Research and Engagement. So we're very happy for that. But these are some of the faces that are working on this project. There's a couple in the room today as well. But just a little shout out to them. And lastly, just some acknowledgments for help with this project. My advisor, Mona, Jen, and my committee, my assistant, Emily, Paul Super in the park, UTK Herbarium, University of Tennessee, and the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions.